Hello and welcome. It's another podcast from Books of the Year. We are a podcast. We talk about books that come out in the year, but by calling it Books of the Year, it makes it sound important.
It does. We do sound a little self-important, which I like. I'm going to lean into that in us being amazing.
And it's very odd to have podcast hosts who sound self-important.
Yes.
I find it very rarely, happens.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for getting in touch, all the correspondence that comes in. Leo Davidson says, hello, bookworms. I have just written out my Christmas reading list. I do this every year and try to get through four books over the festive holiday period.
Excellent. I love this.
Usually
I love this.
Three novels and one nonfiction.
Okay.
You'll be pleased to hear that 75% of the list is made up of recommendations from your brilliant pod.
Wow. Okay.
They are The Art of a Lie by Laura Shepherd Robinson.
Good choice.
The Siege by Ben McIntyre.
Excellent choice.
And Carla's Choice by Nick Harkaway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My fourth choice is a slightly older book that I have been meaning to read for ages, Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. Because there's always one book that we've never quite got round to.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed I can get through all of them. Keen to know what might be on your Christmas reading list. Cheers, lads.
Lads.
Says Leo. Well, I have to say, on my Christmas reading list, there is precisely nothing.
Yeah, I was about to say the same.
I have said to family and friends, please, please, don't give me a book.
Okay.
Because I have so many.
Right.
And if you are going to get me a book, get me a book which is something to do with the book that I'm writing.
Okay.
And so that's why, for my birthday, I got a book which was called Sermons from the Great Ejection, which is a collection of Puritan sermons from the 1650s.
Superb.
It's a rocking book.
I'll bet.
Full of the most miserable creatures on God's earth.
Don't do that.
Yes. So, really, Leo, I appreciate the spirit of what you're saying, but I just don't want to have a book for Christmas.
No. Normally at Christmas, I always make sure, and I think I've said this before, I always make sure I have an Ian Rankin, because normally Ian Rankin's got one out, and I'm not sure whether he's got one out this Christmas, so I'm going to have to find something else to read instead. But I really applaud that, Leo. You are, my goodness me, those are four very, very good books. You're going to have an excellent
If I was going to be pushed, and I'm excited about this because Anne Cleves is coming on the podcast. It's our last one of the year.
Yeah.
And her new book, The Killing Stones, is fantastic. And I have read very little of Anne's books. So I think I would be saying, look, if you have to get me a book, I'm going to start reading Anne Cleves.
Okay.
In the way I read Michael Connelly,
right,
which is find everything.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I guess, Leo, thank you for the question. I guess that's what
Do you know what? Michael Connelly, that's what I'm going to read. That's what I'm going to read this Christmas, because I've not read his latest one. An email from Natasha says, I love the podcast and all your recommendations. I enjoyed your recent Romantasy episode with Callie Hart, and it's made me want to try reading some. I have fallen somewhat into a rather safe reading routine, and I think it would be good to get out of my comfort zone, even if I don't like it. I applaud that, Natasha. So I'm going in. I've decided to start with Fourth Wing by Rebecca Yarros. She's huge, which Callie mentioned on your pod. It seems to be the book that kicked off this whole craze. I'll let you know how I get on, says Natasha. Well, I applaud that, Natasha, because as we said in that episode, this is very much a genre that has passed both of us by, but is huge, massive. And as you said in that episode, you know, publishing houses literally taking on more staff to be able to cope with the demand. So there must be something. They're doing something right.
I know. And if I could work out a way of putting a damn dragon in my and a fairy and a pixie in my new story, believe me, I would.
And getting saucy with each other.
Yes, a saucy dragon.
Saucy dragon.
Could that be a time? Would that work?
Let's try that. Someone get on to Macmillan. I've got an idea. Saucy dragons.
Oh, dear me. It's going to be the next call from my editor. You can email us at any time, books@theyear@yahoo.com. We're on Instagram, Threads and Blue Sky at Pick Any Page. Now let's talk to top journalist and best-selling author Jonathan Friedland. And Jonathan Friedland is in our studio, which is always a very, very good thing. Jonathan, how are you? Very nice to see you.
It's very good to see you too. I'm fine. I'm back from 2.5 weeks on the road promoting this book in the United States, which is a whole other
experience. Did they let you in? Have they not seen what you write?
I have genuine angst about that, I had. And I thought, you know, there were people advising me, oh, delete all your social media accounts. And I thought, that's going to achieve nothing, because it's one Google click away to exactly see what I've been writing. So I braced myself, but no, I got in fine.
Wow. Okay. Well, Jonathan is here because The Traitor's Circle is his new book. Matt, describe the cover, please.
Yes, so the front cover is mainly, the background mainly dark, mainly black, but right in the top left-hand corner, we have a shot from above of a man and woman walking down a cobbled street, and clearly it's from the 1930s, 1940s, that kind of dress, with the light shining behind them. But then the traitor's circle in blood red right across the centre, the rebels against the Nazis and the spy who betrayed them, Jonathan Friedland at the bottom, from the best-selling author of The Escape Artist, yes, which obviously we featured on this podcast.
I realise that the key to getting a best-selling book is to have traitors in the title.
Yeah.
And so I have now decided to retitle my next book. I'm not quite sure where traitors is going to turn up, but it's the word of the year.
It is.
Isn't it? And obviously there won't be a single person that buys this thinking it's got a foreword by Claudia or anything like that.
Great idea, though, now that you mention that, for the paperback. That's a great idea.
So if someone goes in and says, hello, have you got anything about the traitors? Certainly.
Yes!
The Traitor Circle, Jonathan Friedland, shoots to the top of the bestseller. You've got a quote from Claudia on the front, that would be. It's top marketing, I think.
Yes, no, that's great intel you've provided there. We'll take that to the meeting.
We had you on the podcast talking about The Escape Artist, and we talked then about your history as a thriller writer and now writing real-life history in a thrillery kind of style. So take us into the world of The Traitor's Circle, because I know that there is a link between The Escape Artist and The Traitor's Circle. You know, stories that you pick up on as you research one book might lead you to the next one. Tell us how you ended up telling this tale.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. So The Escape Artist, which you kindly had me on to talk about when it came out, tells the story of true story, 19-year-old Jewish man, boy, really, who escaped from Auschwitz in the spring of 1944. Almost unheard of to do it. Only a handful of people ever achieved it. He was among the very first. And he did it in order to warn the world. And that happened, as I say, he got out with Fred Wetzler in April 1944. In July 1944, there was the famous July 20th assassination attempt of Adolf Hitler, the von Stauffenberg plot. People know that from the Valkyrie movie with a, to my mind, slightly miscast Tom Cruise. It meant that by the summer of 1944, there was anxiety in the upper reaches of the SS, arguing that perhaps things were unraveling, things were out of control. So Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, by then really the second most powerful man in Nazi Germany, addressed the senior top brass of the SS, the Gauleiters, to reassure them, essentially, we've got this. Things are not unraveling on our watch. And as an example, so I was reading that speech as part of the research for The Escape Artist. As part of that speech, he mentions, as if to give evidence of how they've got a grip, he says, for example, the reactionary cabal that were prattling over tea, you know, the ambassador, the widow Solf and the diplomat Otto Kiep, we've all got them now, he says. And I truthfully just saw this word tea and thought, what was that? What's he referring to here? What's this episode? And you sort of, I'm making the gesture of sort of clicking on the footnotes, and you go deeper and deeper into it, and you discover that sure enough, on the 10th of September 1943, a group, 9 or 10, top drawer aristocratic elite Germans who had in common one thing, which is that they were defying or resisting Adolf Hitler, had indeed gathered for a secret tea party. What they did not know is that sitting around the table with them was someone who they thought was one of their own, a kindred spirit, but who instead was about to betray them all to the Gestapo. And the minute I saw that in the, you know, undergrowth of the footnotes, I thought, that's a story. And not only is it a story, it's a kind of whodunit, a real-life whodunit, because the cast of characters, elite, top-drawer Germans, tea party, betrayal, and resistance, it seemed to have everything in it to make a whodunit, I thought.
So given that this story has been there-ish in footnotes, and you've pieced it together and told it for the first time, before we get into the weeds of it, I'm intrigued as to why this story has not been told before. Because, as you mentioned, these are top-draw Germans. These aren't an oppressed minority.
No.
These are people who write history. These are people who are noticed, and their families have been noticed. So why is it that this story has not been noticed?
You're quite right that about how they'd been noticed at the time. It was a huge story. It culminates, obviously, once they have been informed upon. I'm not giving anything away to say there's a whole hunt and arrest and eventually a huge show trial, which was a massive news story at the time on the front pages of every German newspaper, but it made news around the world as well. So it is a real question why it has not been recorded, really. And you're right, it's not been told. I mean, to my astonishment, there is no book on this in German, even. There are academic papers, there's family biographies of some of the individual members, but it's never been told all in one go. The best guess or theory I can have on it is that the post-war German collective narrative has been to say, we must admirably reckon with our guilt and our past, and that means we've got to face up to the crimes we committed and the overwhelming majority of Germans who went along with those crimes, and that it is somehow an act of displacement or denial to big up the handful of people who resisted. And that's why that's my working explanation for another, to me, intriguing fact, which is this book is going to be or is already translated into Dutch, French, Italian, Spanish, Finnish, Portuguese, but not German. The German publishers have so far not gone for this, and I think it's because they're saying that it would almost be, an inadequate analogy, but would American publishers want to publish a book about the good plantation owner in the South?
I see, yeah.
Or would it feel like you're in denial about the fact that most went along with slavery? You know, I think it must have that feel about it for Germans, and because they are the ones who knew this history. If they weren't telling it, it wasn't going to get told.
So you're touching on something that I think you recognise is right at the heart of this book, Jonathan, which is the question, what would you have done in this situation? And I'm sure all of us in this room and everyone listening to this podcast is what we're all telling ourselves. If I had been in that situation in the 1930s in Germany, I would have performed some small act of rebellion. And yet, there is probably a little dark voice at the back of our heads and that is saying, "Are you really that brave? Are you really? Because you've not shown that degree of courage up until now, and you think you'd have done that when not only are you putting yourself in harm's way, you're putting your family in harm's way." There are two reactions that you have in the book from people, and several pages apart. But I just want to read so you have. It doesn't matter who these characters are, but there are two reactions to what do I do in this situation. One guy says, "So what if I can't buy the newspaper I used to buy? I'll buy another. And as for getting the Jews out of Germany, I have nothing against that." And then you have someone else who says, "If you were against them, why weren't you in a concentration camp? Why are you still alive unless you were a Nazi?" In other words, if I say something, if I fight against this, people won't believe me because I wasn't sent to a camp. And I just feel that's right at the centre. Do I do something? Because if I do, I am putting myself in harm's way.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to the question that I think really animated my sort of interest in this story. Because I think whenever we look at anything from this period, you know, and we do all the time, I mean, it's told and retold, the new movie Nuremberg, you know, it's there. I think the almost sort of assumed, implied question is, what would I have done? Exactly as you've said. And very quick on the heels of that question to ourselves is, well, obviously I would have been with the resistance. When you watch those movies, you're rooting for the resistance on this emotional assumption or premise, of course I'd have been with them. I think that voice you describe, that sort of darker voice, gets louder when you read this book for two reasons. First, you realise, how hard it was to stray out of line. The risks were so great. This was a society of total conformity and totalitarian enforcement. Every newspaper you read was controlled by the Nazis, the radio. I did not know that there were speakers on lampposts and in cafes broadcasting Goebbels' speeches and Hitler's speeches all the time. So there's that. But the other thing is just the numbers. So there was one Allied and American war crimes investigator comes into Germany in post-war 1945. His job is to interview Germans, both guilty and innocent. And he comes up with this estimate that 3 million Germans were detained, arrested, imprisoned in different forms for so-called crimes of dissent. Maybe even just a critical remark, over the 12-year period of the Reich. Now, 3 million is a big number. Of those, he estimates 500,000 were put to death. Big number. And yet, you then look at the German citizen population at the time, it means around 5% strayed out of line, paid a heavy price. 95% did not. I think it then requires huge self-confidence, if not arrogance, for us to sit in 2025, 26 and say, well, obviously I'd have been one of those 5%. You've got to be pretty sure if 95% don't, and people who've got, and of those 95%, you notice it's people who've got things to lose, families, professional standing, a job, a home, dependents. They're the ones who, not uniformly, tend to stay in line. It requires a huge amount. And all that does for me is it makes me admire all the more the 9 or 10 extraordinary characters who sat around that table and did risk everything.
Speaking of them, because that's, it's their story. If I've remembered my history correctly, before the Nazis came to power, when there were still elections, the two groups in German society who sort of stayed more or less immune to the Nazi Party were the cradle-to-grave organizations of socialists and Catholics. They had their own parties, and they stayed separate. Obviously, then the elections stopped happening in 1933. So these people, the 9 or 10 that you're talking about, are not the usual suspects. These aren't communists. They're not trade unionists. They're not, I don't know if they're devoutly Catholic or whatever. But what is it about these guys? If they're all well-to-do, they obviously have an awful lot to lose. Maybe they have more to lose than someone in the lower reaches of society. But so what is it about these guys? Are they friends? Did they know each other beforehand? Were they radicals? What was it that put them together?
Well, so they absolutely are not those ideological, political dissidents. Those people are rounded up and caught up within weeks of the Nazi takeover of power. We know it from the sermon that became a poem. First they came for the communists, then they came for the trade unionists. By the spring of 1933, that kind of organized ideological opposition, they've fled the country or they're in concentration camps. So if you're talking about 1943, you're having to talk about a very different group of people. And it's interesting you pick up on the point about faith, because that question of what kind of person does it take to resist is the other question that runs through this book that comes alongside what would I have done? They're in a way, they're two sides of the same coin, because we're asking ourselves, is there a type? And if so, am I it? And what I've discovered about this group is that the thread they have in common isn't particularly political with a capital P. It's not even sociological. It is that they have a belief in an authority higher than the Nazi Party and higher than Adolf Hitler. They believe they are answerable to a force higher than just the government of the day. And for some of them, it's because they're really posh. They're aristocrats who come from families that they believe are the real Germany, who represent a Germany that will outlive the Third Reich and Nazism, and they have ancestors who they almost feel accountable to. And so there are people there, there isn't just one countess in this group, there's two, and one of those was hugely influenced by her father and just feels as if, what would he say? you know, of the idea of a von Maltzan going along with mistreating the oppressed like this, a patrician ideal that you're meant to honour. That's one motivation. But the other one is religious faith. So several of the people around that Tea Party were very committed Christians, and they believed when a knock on the door came from the Gestapo, yes, you're frightened, but how you act will ultimately be judged not by the Führer, but by Jesus Christ. That's what they think. And therefore, they feel that they have to be accountable in the eyes of God. And that gives them a kind of confidence to feel that Hitler will come and go, but, you know, there is a more powerful force. I think that is what put steel in the spine of some of these people, that where everyone else was thinking there is no mightier force in the world than this, surely the most terrifying regime in human history, which it was. They nevertheless felt they had to hold themselves to account to a higher authority.
Fascinating.
I want to talk to you about Leo Langer. Am I pronouncing that right? Okay, so Leo Langer, who we meet initially as the guy who is hunting down these so-called traitors, these people who are going against the Nazi cause, but who in subsequent chapters we realise is directly involved in mass murder. And I wanted to... Right. When I was reading the chapters involving Leo, and Jonathan, you should absolutely step in and tell me I'm wrong here. But when I was reading the chapters involving Leo, it struck me that your style of writing had slightly changed when you were talking about Leo as opposed to the other characters in this story. And that is that it felt to me that those chapters, you were just writing down the facts. In other words, no adjectives and no need for adjectives, because these facts and these acts were so appalling, so shocking, that I don't need to direct the reader in any way. So I suppose my question is this. Number one, I want you to talk about who Leo was and what he did. But also, am I right with that, in that your style of writing did change for those sections involving Leo?
So let's talk about very perceptive observation, by the way. I think you're completely right. I'll come to that point about language in a minute. So Leo Langer was a Gestapo officer who was posted with the German occupying army to Poland, and there gets a responsibility for initially executing Polish prisoners of the new German occupiers, basically anyone who might pose a threat of resistance, until he gets a call saying, we want you to trial a new method of killing that we're just sort of testing. It involves gas. And he and his unit, the Langer detachment, roam around the Polish countryside in a van, with a van, and they stop at psychiatric hospitals to round up people we would call now people with learning difficulties. They would have called people the mentally defective. They entice them to this van that has the logo of a coffee company on the side, falsely, and put them into the loading bay of the van, close the doors, and release poison gas, initially from sort of cylinders, eventually from the exhaust. Drive around for a bit, open up the van, and there are 30 or 40 corpses inside. And they do this hour after hour, place after place, killing thousands of people, modulating the technique, seeing how long it takes, seeing what the state of the corpses are, until eventually the gas chamber on wheels, which is what it is, becomes static, and it becomes a part of a camp whose sole purpose is death. And the victims now are not those people in the so-called euthanasia program, but are now the Nazis' real target, namely Jews, the Jews of Poland. What has been born under Leo Langer is the first death camp at Chełmno, a name that has sort of been forgotten. But before, long before there was Auschwitz or Treblinka, there was Chełmno. It was the first death camp, and its first commandant was Leo Langer. He ends up being the detective on the trail of the people at the Tea Party. I sort of am still surprised by this in a way, because I knew when writing this, if I'm going to write it like a whodunit, and I really wanted to respect the genre, there would have to be a detective. I also knew that somewhere in this book, I would have to, as it were, remind the reader of what's at stake. Why are this group so committed, even to the point of risking their lives and everything, to fight Nazism? For that, you have to remind people, the reader, of the Nazis' crimes. I had no idea that the detective, who I pictured being some slightly, you know, Babylon Berlin, remember that's a very good TV show, a sort of shoe leather, you know, dirty Mac German detective, I had no idea that it would in fact be one of the central, if overlooked, figures of the Holocaust. I mean, he's right there. He's the founder or the innovator, the pioneer of the gas chamber and the commandant of the first death camp. He is on their trail. Without me needing to do anything, the, as it were, the stakes of the story are spelled out, which brings me to your very good question about language. You are completely right about it. I don't know how conscious it was, but it's something I had already, fallen into in the earlier book, The Escape Artist, which is this paired back register. There is a particular register which I realize I've always used when writing about the Holocaust, which is no embellishment, no dramatization, no adjectives, really, because the facts themselves are so devastating and they don't need any, you know, you don't need the string section. You just need the facts to speak for themselves. In other parts of the story, I do try to ramp up the tension and use suspense, and I want it to be a page-turner. But when I'm in those bits, the facts themselves should command and have power.
So on that question about writing style, Jonathan, when you are writing a book like this, which is a true story, how much, if any, leeway do you give yourself to say someone was scared or there was a smell of, so that we're in the room, the standard things that you would want if you were writing one of your thrillers, you would, if someone walks into the room, you'd say what it looks like, what it feels like, what it smells like, just so that we're in the room with them. Do you allow yourself that luxury to be able to just put ourselves slightly in the senses of these people?
No, I don't. And so, but I was able to do it, describe the room, describe the fear, describe the senses, because of the wealth of documentary evidence that I had. So it's extraordinary to me that I can tell you what they were eating at the tea party and the room they were in and whether it was cramped or not, because they all, in different forms, whether it was under interrogation, whether it was testifying, as one did at the Nuremberg tribunals after the war, whether it's letters, diaries, the transcripts of the trial, there was just a wealth of information. And some, because I don't want to give away, thanks to you, we're artfully stepping around not saying who the betrayer was or even who survived and who didn't, but some did survive. And those people were able to, and even actually some who didn't, were able through visits and so on to tell relatives everything about what had happened, which then did get recorded even post-war. So there was real detail about people's emotional state. They record conversations, which, I mean, those bits of dialogue that you read out earlier came from accounts that were firsthand. So I really policed myself very rigidly, rigorously to say there's going to be nothing made up in this book. It's nonfiction. The only thing I allowed myself was to do the thing that, you know, Simon, about writing thrillers, which is withholding information. So that's where the suspense and tension that I would, even if actually, strictly speaking, somebody did know X at that moment, I might not let the reader know that yet, because you want there to be the cliffhanger at the end of the chapter and so on.
You don't want to pull back the curtains any earlier than you need to. But you do draw back the curtains sooner than you would do if you were writing a thriller.
That is
presumably
true.
Because your story would miss out on a lot of detail if you don't tell us what we need to know halfway through.
Yeah, it's true. So if you were being completely true to the Agatha Christie genre, and I did reread, and then there were none before sitting down to write this, she doesn't tell you the whodunit is not answered till the last or second last page. And I did think, is there a way to do that with this? And there just isn't, because you don't want to exclude, for example, the trial. So, you know, the trial of those details, those answers emerge, and similarly when they're in detention and so on. And so there's new areas of tension then, which is, well, what's going to happen to the betrayer? What's going to happen to the group? Are they going to get tracked down? Are they going to survive? So, yes, strictly speaking, that all of that would have been withheld, but I just couldn't do that and stay faithful to the story. I still think it works anyway. And there is a twist that I have kept back to the second last page, which to me is a completely sort of devastating thing. And I thought, okay, well, that's my homage to the form. You do have to read to the very end to know every last twist.
So, obviously, we want people to read this book, Jonathan. And whenever I'm sort of championing a book like this, I always think in terms of like a movie trailer. And if this book were a movie, which of the little stories within this book would I put in the trailer? And people can sort of have their own thoughts, but here's mine. My pick for the story to put in the trailer would be the story of the woman in the lake with the pumpkin. If you put that in the trailer, I am watching that movie. So I want you to tell the story of the woman in the lake with the pumpkin.
It's an amazing story, isn't it? And she is an amazing person. Countess Maria von Maltzen, aristocrat, in some ways the most, you know, the poshest of all of them. She grew up in a literal castle, you know, with ballrooms and libraries and domed hallways and the largest private collection of engravings anywhere in Europe. Proper aristocracy. She's a complete rebel. And in a way, she's in some ways the most sort of hands-on resistor of all of them. She's involved in physical resistance. She's hiding Jews in her apartment. She's getting people out of the city via the sewers in Berlin. She fires a weapon at one point. She's sort of, you know, heiress meets Lara Croft. You know, she's a kind of action hero. One of the things she does is there was a secret group known as the Black Swimmers, meaning they swam at night. They would ferry people across, escorting them by swimming, Jews who needed to escape the country across Lake Constance, where one shore was Germany, and then if you reached the other shore, about 2 hours of swimming, you would be in Switzerland. And she did that with a woman who was a Jewish woman who was probably about 60 years old, who somehow found the strength in her to swim across the shore. Maria was her sort of escort and companion, swam across with her, then had to swim back. And what she did was she had always said that she got this from a children's story. She tied a pumpkin to, probably hollowed out, actually, I would guess, on a rope and had it attached to her ankle, so that as she swam along, the pumpkin was sort of bobbing along beside her. When she reached a moment where suddenly there were searchlights moving across the surface of the water, this is where it looks like a movie trailer, there were police boats searching Lake Constance, looking for exactly this kind of activity, people who are escaping. She then dives deep, waits until she is sure the pumpkin is in the sights of the beam of the searchlight, hears underwater the sound of machine gun fire, blowing apart the pumpkin head that looks like a human head, until she then can hear the engine of the boat receding into the distance. She bursts up to the surface, sees that the pumpkin is in shreds, and realizes it has done its job. It's acted as a decoy. They think they have shot the resistor while she was underwater. I mean, it's an extraordinary story, again, fully documented.
I like the idea of finding a little kind of cameo to put in the trailer. The submarine in Berlin, the countess, was it a countess with
the same person?
It's the same person. Well, okay. Well, she's amazing, because I lose track of who was.
Yeah.
She has a Jewish lover, and the Gestapo come in. So we're right in the heart of the Third Reich.
Yeah, that was the other story I thought you were going to nominate. I think those are the two for the trailer. Incredible story. She was harbouring, at any one point, it could be as many as 20 people hiding this small apartment of hers. Jews, incredibly, were there, 1,500 or so, clung on to life in the heart of the Nazi Empire. They were there in Berlin, even at the height of the Holocaust. They were effectively under Hitler's nose. It's an amazing idea, where he's roaming across all of Europe, you know, Salonika and Greece and Holland and Belgium, finding Jews in Poland and Russia. there they were in Berlin. They were in hiding. As you say, they were known as submarines because they had to be beneath the surface, hidden and silent. And she had a whole protocol for the Jews who hid in her apartment. They weren't allowed to speak because neighbours might overhear and inform on them. They weren't allowed to cook food because there would be smoke coming out of the chimney. They were, or, you know, if you lit the stove, they weren't allowed to flush the toilet because that noise would alert them. But among that group was her own, this was, of course, her biggest secret, her own secret Jewish lover, completely forbidden. The Nuremberg laws of 1935 had barred what they called race mixing. She was not allowed to have a Jewish lover. She did. And they had worked out a protocol, which is, if ever there was a knock on the door from the Gestapo, he had a hiding place, which was a kind of wooden cavity under a mattress, like a sofa bed, but this space, a crawl space. And she was very handy, as you would expect of this kind of Lara Croft figure, with a drill. And she'd put all these bolts in there so it could be locked from the inside. Each day when she would go off to work, she would leave inside a glass of water and two tablets of codeine to suppress the cough that might give him away. Sure enough, the Gestapo do come one day. He gets into the space as soon as he hears the knock on the door. She ushers them in. They interrogate her. At one point, they interrogate her while she is sitting on the sofa bed. She's saying how ridiculous to think there are any Jews here while he's hiding underneath. And eventually she says, look, if you're so convinced that there is a Jew in hiding in this couch, because they tried to get it open and they couldn't, why don't you just take out your gun now and shoot through the couch? Now, do it. And they are, you know, as it were, reaching for the pistol when she says, however, I have one condition. If you shoot through this couch, I want you to pay me compensation for the destruction of the upholstery and the repair, and I want that in advance and in writing. And the key, the brilliance of her is to know that these Gestapo men are ultimately bureaucrats who will have forms to fill in and expenses claims to make, and they don't want to stray beyond their authority. This incredibly imperious aristocratic woman has told them that she would demand, you know, a chit with compensation to repair her sofa, and so they don't do it. And that I love that story, partly because it's action and tension, but also because it shows that how her aristocratic bearing and confidence was so important in daring to face down the Gestapo.
That story could have had a very different ending, but it doesn't, and is one of the many extraordinary stories in The Traitor's Circle by Jonathan Friedland. In the footnotes, Jonathan, have you found another book?
You know, I haven't yet. There is potential in there, but after... It's been 6 years since I began work on The Escape Artist, and I went straight from that into this. And it is, it takes a toll, this material. It just does. And I have decided that I'm just going to give myself, you know, not indefinite, but a pause and a break while I sort of take stock rather than plunging straight into the next one.
Yeah. And maybe the next one can have some sunlit uplands.
Yes.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I was drawn to this story partly because I thought, compared to the story of a man in Auschwitz, I thought the story of 9 or 10 people who behave so heroically and who are the best of humanity, having looked at the very worst of humanity in a book centered on Auschwitz, that there is something inspiring about these people. And, you know, the times we live in now, without drawing any facile parallels, the times we are in now where people are being tested about whether they stand up to, you know, would-be autocrats and authoritarians, not just in one place, all over the world, the courage of these people would be a kind of inspiration. But I do take your point. It would be nice to go a bit sunnier next time.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. There'll be a Q&A with Jonathan along in a couple of days' time. But for the moment, Jonathan Friedland, thank you very much.
Thank you.